Well, hello out there in podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Network of Podcasts, the podcast for people who actually like movies. And welcome to a very special episode. We've never done anything like this, and so join us on this maiden voyage for what we're going to be doing tonight. And maybe if it works out, we'll do something like this again. We're going to be not just talking about one movie. We're going to be talking about an entire year of movies. We are going to be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the year in film 1994. So we're going to be talking all things 1994, and I'll talk about why we're choosing 1994 in just a minute. But first, I want to introduce our panel. We've got a good lineup of guests tonight. First off, I want to start off with the birthday boy, at least on this recording, as we're recording this. You're not going to be hearing this on his birthday, but we're recording tonight. He's joining us on his birthday. Please welcome the co-host of Flashbacks on the Front Row Network, Ryan Lutens. How's it going, Ryan?
Good. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to do something, talk about movies on my birthday.
Well, we are excited to have you. Also joining us is the host of Pop Culture Draft Night for the Front Row Network. Please welcome Phil Rockwell. How's it going, Phil?
Very well. Evening, all. Happy birthday, Ryan.
Thank you.
And joining us, the host of Beyond the Mouse and the associate editor for the Front Row Network. Please welcome back Mr. Craig McFarland. How's it going, Craig?
Hey, it's weird to not be on a Disney movie for once, although I'm sure we'll talk about a couple Disney movies. And happy birthday, Mr. Lutens. We could all sing to you because that's fair game now, but we're not going to.
Thank you.
I was explicitly told there would be no singing on the podcast. All right. And rounding out the panel, please welcome back a regular contributor to the Front Row Network podcast. Welcome back, Aaron McCabe. How's it going, Aaron?
Oh, so excited and stoked to be here. I do love everything 80s and 90s. And happy birthday, Ryan.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So let's get into it. So here's the deal, people. Earlier this year, a book came out. It's a really good book, by the way, if you haven't read it yet, called, I believe it's called Best Movie Year. And it's a book about 1999. And there's been a lot of talk in online because of that and on podcasts talking about 1999 as the greatest movie year ever. And it's always one of those fun conversations to say, okay, well, what's the best movie year ever? And the year that came to mind to me and was at least perfect to talk about now because it was making its 25th anniversary is 1994. In fact, you can go to our website right now, our frnpod.com, and you can see an article that I wrote about 1994, 50 movies that prove that 1994 is the greatest movie year of all time. So out of that spawned this idea of, hey, let's talk about what all 1994 had to offer in terms of movies. So that's what we're going to get into. Before we get into the movies themselves, let's just talk about a couple of the other pop culture staples, because this is kind of a bonkers year in pop culture. So a couple of other things happening in 1994. The O.J. Simpson trial would start later in 1994. We're actually recording this, I think this is the day after the anniversary of the famous Bronco chase.
That was on my birthday on June 12th, 1994.
Oh, excuse me. Well, yeah. happy belated birthday to you then.
Thanks. I spent it watching the Bronco chase on the news.
Yeah, so that was a big deal. Earlier in the year, we had another sports-related scandal with the Nancy Kerrigan incident, the hit on her that was done by Tonya Harding and her husband and a third person. So that dominated the first half of 94, and OJ took over, dominated the rest of 94 into 95. Music-wise, this is also the 25th anniversary of Kurt Cobain's death, which was a major pop culture event something that I think it still affects music to this day. But a couple of the albums that came out in 1994, we have Green Day's Dookie. We had The Downward Spiral by Nine Inch Nails. We had Weezer's Blue album, Beastie Boys' Ill Communication, and the Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die. So like kind of really stellar lineup of albums. On television, Friends and ER debuts. In video games, the PlayStation is released. In tech stuff, Amazon and Yahoo are all introduced. So a lot of stuff going on in 1994. So before we segue into the movies, anything that I missed or anything that you want to say about any the year in pop culture for 94, but we start talking about the movie specific. Let's start with the birthday boy, Ryan.
I really can't think of anything, but I mean, you know, you have such a big year for music, like you mentioned. More or less with the music, what I was going to say is B.I.G. and Tupac, you know, they're really starting to hit their popularity. And then when their tragic deaths happen, it just leads to this whole new world of the rap game. So really pivotal for these guys to really take off in the music business. So I'm a teacher and the students are like, oh, I listen to this rapper. I go, listen to the good stuff. So,
oh, you're one of those.
Says the white guy teacher.
Right.
Yeah. If there's one thing I've ever learned is if when you need some serious hip hop recommendations, you go to Ryan Luton.
So, right. Yeah.
Few people right. know he's our hip hop aficionado for the network. I'm stoked to get to hear your podcast on it. It's
I'm gonna say this once. Word.
All right, Phil, anything about 1994, the year that sticks out to you?
94, I was in junior high, which means I was all up in my own head. So I don't remember much of the sort of zeitgeist. But I will say this, looking over the top 100 films, I've seen like 70% of them, which is, well, granted, I've seen a lot of movies, but still that number was kind of crazy to me as I went through that list. I've seen a ton of these movies.
Yeah, I had too. And that's interesting that you bring that up. And because I'm the same age as you are, Phil, I graduated junior high and entered high school this year. And so maybe this is the year where I think I start going to movies so regularly that I saw so many of these movies. And so I wonder if that colors my judgment a little bit, which we can dive into later. But Aaron, how about you?
Both of you guys have kind of hit on what I was thinking of when I was going over this list is when I think back to this year and I think of how old I was at the time, I'm 2 years younger. So at this time in 1994, I'm 12. So my parents are gatekeeping a lot more of my media consumption at this time before I reach that age where I'm deciding what I want to go see. I actually don't start picking a lot of my own movies or going to the theater with my friends and stuff like that until like 96, 97. And so what I noticed when I was looking at this list, I've seen a lot of these movies. I don't know if this falls for anybody else. Or anyone who would listen to the podcast who can remember back to that year. But there are a lot of these movies I didn't see in a theater and I didn't actually see them. Yeah, I saw them at other people's houses or I saw them on cable or I saw them on pay-per-view or something like that because, you know, it's now a movie comes out and it goes to a streaming platform very, very quickly. And in 1994 and in the 90s, we all had to wait for it to go to a secondary theater and then be released on VHS. So, you know, many of these movies actually, I was like, oh my gosh, these were all in 1994. I thought it was 95, 96, 97, because that's actually when they started filtering through into my own hands.
Mm-hmm. All right, Craig, how about you? Anything about the year in general before we get into the movie?
A couple of things. Just like Aaron said, it really, you know, I saw all of these after the fact because I was 8 years old in 94. My cat's walking around my iPad. So I was 8 years old in 1994. And one thing in particular, I remember seeing all these Jim Carrey movies and thinking, oh my goodness, this guy has had quite a run. Even as a little kid, I was like, this guy just can't miss. Obviously, he can miss. We found that out. But I didn't realize that, you know, so many of his good movies came out in 1 year. The only thing I would add to you talking about the OJ trial is that I've been a cord cutter now for a long time, so I don't have the FX. So I have not been able to see The People versus OJ until now. Netflix finally bought it and put it on their streaming platform. So if you were like me and you missed what everyone was talking about as this great series, I just started it last night and it is really, really great. And especially for someone that I distinctly remember the Bronco, I distinctly remember the not guilty verdict. Outside of that, though, I didn't follow along with the drama because I was 8 years old. So it just wasn't as enveloping of my life and my pop culture at the time. But definitely go back and check that out, and it's available on Netflix.
The other thing about that show that's very apparent to people who have a clearer memory of it is just how much of that story was dictated by the media. And the way they presented it, the things that they wanted to see, the way they handle Marcia Clark in that show is a revelation, because you realize just how thick with misogyny so much of the coverage was. You know, just the fact that they focused on her hair and how she looked, and she's, you know, she couldn't be too mean because she was a lady and the jury's not going to like a mean lady and blah, blah, blah. And, that show is nothing short of a masterpiece in my estimation. Actually, that makes, with OJ Made in America, that's two OJ related masterpieces in the course of like 14 months or something like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm glad you brought it up, Craig. Yeah. If, you know, we'll digress into movies for a second, but just for television. Yeah. The People versus OJ Simpson, such a great show. And it is such a great depiction of that time and that era. So as you said, Phil, somebody who I remember when high schools stopped what they were doing to show the verdict.
I remember hearing it at school
that it was that big of a cultural moment, and it really defined that time. If you're going to go back, definitely check it out. But let's get into the movies now of 1994. What we're here to really talk about is to dive into this lineup. So what makes this lineup so dynamic? And I think I want to start with our Best Picture nominees, because I think that'll give you a little bit of a taste of the direction we're going, and you will then will kind of segue from there. So the five films that end up getting nominated for Best Picture this year for the 1995 Oscars are Forrest Gump, which is the highest grossing film of the year, in addition to what will ultimately win Best Picture, Pulp Fiction, The Shawshank Redemption, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and Quiz Show. So let's start. I think we got to start with the number one, the highest grossing film of the year, Forrest Gump. Just some thoughts on that movie and its cultural moment. What do you think it meant at the time, and how do you think its impact got felt? Phil, let's start with you.
Forrest Gump is a movie that I don't think... I think you couldn't hear a bad word about it when it came out. I mean, it's certainly a movie that's meant to be uplifting and inspiring. I think as a modern movie viewer, there is a ton of stuff that is racially problematic. The depiction of Jenny is kind of gross now. The depiction of a person on the spectrum by a normal actor. There's just a lot of stuff that you kind of wince at when you look at it, when you look at it through a modern lens. Plus it's corny. I mean, it is a schmaltzy, cheesy movie.
You're really helping my case here, Phil.
Look, you know, it's not like we haven't seen Best Picture winners that don't age well. I don't think this is there's no malice in this movie, but it's just a movie that just for modern sensibilities, it leaves a lot. It leaves you wanting a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I think, as you mentioned, it was a high earner that year. I agree with Phil. If you look back at a lot of movies, you've got to remember that they were made in a particular time and place. And so it is hard to put a modern lens on everything. But I understand the concerns about some of the moments in the film as well. But, you know, I think just I'm such a Tom Hanks lover. And this was one of those performances that he kind of stepped out of what he had been doing before. Again, in modern sensibilities, do you have someone play someone that's sort of on the spectrum without necessarily having experienced that themselves or really delving into that? But we've learned so much more about autism since this movie came out. But to me, it's a good film. obviously cemented Gary Sinise in my mind as a great actor. And I loved him in the TV miniseries The Stand, which I don't remember exactly when that came out in the 90s. I know it was in the 90s sometime. But just my love for Tom Hanks follows through to this movie. It's not like I would pick it up and choose to watch it out of all these movies from 1994. But that's usually true of most Best Picture winners.
Okay. Aaron, how about you? Thoughts?
I asked myself the same question when I was looking at the movies. Like, does it still hold up? Would I love it as much as 12-year-old Aaron loved it or 20-year-old Aaron loved it? And while I do see the points that it's a little bit, it's obviously dated and the how they portrayed characters is also dated, I guess I don't wince as much at it because, again, it's like it was 25 years ago. So everyone's doing the best they can with what they have. And so when I look at that with the way that they portrayed characters, the way that they portray, and first of all, I guess I never took it at that he was on an autism spectrum, only because he displays a large amount of empathy. And like, yeah, there's just some things about him that, like, I guess if I had to compare him to an autism, like to if I had to compare him to a character with autism, like he's not close to Rain Man to me. Like I just, it was like, okay, right. Lower IQ, very, but I get what you're saying. Like that is a little wincy. Like, are we,
and I think the fact that it's kind of non-specific to like what his ailment is, which from looking at it from a modern lens, you're like, well, is he just, is dumb? Is there some, which is, I think what makes it more problematic now. I think if you were to do it now, there would be more thought going into, okay, what specifically is his,
because there's more information and exactly. You have more, but I get what you're saying. So I guess because of the, like, because there's less information and frame of reference, maybe in that, like, it doesn't make me wince as much, but I will admit if it is on TV and I'm changing the channels, I will watch it. I think it's got a great soundtrack.
Absolutely.
I think there's a lot of movies that come out of 1994 that have great composers and I'm a very big soundtrack fan. So I think it's got a great soundtrack. I think that has, you know, staying power. And I do find the characters endearing even today. Is it my most favorite movie ever in a modern lens? No, probably not. But like I said, if it's on, I'm not kicking it off the channel.
Yeah. And you know, Tom Hanks, I mean, if you think about it, this was his second, this was his second Oscar win, and really for two completely different roles. You know, he had the win for Philadelphia and then he won for this role. And unfortunately hasn't won since, even though he's been turning in great, acting gigs, just about once every 5 years or so. But, I like that he really became, he did really become that character. He enveloped that character. And again, my love for that man, makes it to where I really enjoy this movie, probably more than I would if it was any other actor.
So it's interesting you say that, Craig. I just read today, or I just saw today, that actually Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, and John Travolta all turned that role down before Tom Hanks accepted it. So what a different movie that may have been, and how different our opinions may have been of that movie had they accepted that role.
One of those three sounds like a really interesting idea.
I'll leave it in interesting in a train wreck kind of way.
No, I mean, I think Bill Murray would be interesting to see how he would take that. I think John Travolta made the right choice in going with Pulp Fiction. I think everybody made the right choice.
Right choices were made.
Yep.
Yes. Ryan, any thoughts on Forrest Gump before we move on?
I'll be brief, just because a lot of the points were hit. I think Gary Sinise, this is his breakout role. He, in my mind, played, I mean, one of the best veterans. Just his character in general, Lieutenant Dan, he nailed it. Everything about his character from when he had legs to when he didn't have legs to when he had metal legs, he really hit and really encompassed what almost all Vietnam veterans felt. But for me, the movie as a whole is like, it was said, it doesn't hold up. But if you think about it, when it came out, the people that were going to see movies, they lived through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And this movie is a nostalgia piece. Embedding his head in everything, superimposing him into real shots. I mean, that's why it was so popular, because people were going for that nice, heartwarming story. But they also like, oh, I remember this. It was like a trip down memory lane for me. I think that's why it was so successful.
Yeah, that was my kind of takeaway from Forrest Gump, because I agree with everything that's been said. I think in the prism of 1994, I think you know, does a lot of what they do hold up in a 2019 perspective? Probably not. But what this movie, I think, did really well was hit the nostalgia stuff, like you said, Ryan, but it also... It's like, to me, if this movie comes out even like a year later, like it's probably like derided, because movies start getting edgier as you get into the 90s, and this movie hits, it still has kind of that like feel good tearjerker of that the 80s had in spades. If you look at the dramas from the 80s, they're all this kind of like, until you get to like Oliver Stone and Spike Lee, it's a lot of like terms of endearment and
fuzzy.
Yeah, exactly. Warm, fuzzy, tearjerker, heart stuff. And this movie does that, but it also is kind of innovative in its use of technology and its special effects, which we hadn't really ever seen employed in a drama before, which is the other thing I think that made this kind of this marvel of oh, here's this drama that's also kind of this CGI spectacle and anchored by a great performance by Tom Hanks. So yeah, I would agree with all of you. I think it's not my pick for best movie of 1994, but I think it's still a lot of things. You can see a lot of people borrowing from Forrest Gump. Actors would try there, you know, lots of actors would try to be a Forrest Gump type character in hopes of an Oscar. None of them would get them. Cuba Gooding Jr., I'm looking in your direction. And that's so that impact is felt. And yeah, I mean, nothing was more, one of the things I think that was the most ubiquitous movie of 1994 is Forrest Gump. It's such a, makes so much money. It's such a big thing. So it was really inescapable at that time. And I think for, at the time, a pretty good reason. So let's move on then to the movie that it really butted heads with a lot in awards season, and that's Pulp Fiction. And I don't know, man. I don't know if you could find a more like broader ends of the spectrum, two films that duked it out in like every award show that year than Forrest Gump versus Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction comes out, it debuts in Sundance in 1994, it gets released in October, and it sends some shockwaves, I think, through the movie industry. It changes a lot of things. I think its impact's really something that we're going to talk a lot about. So let's go around, Robin, and I don't think we need to, you know, if everybody wants to chime in, they can, but if you want to yield your time in the interest of brevity, we can. But let's go around, and who's got some thoughts about, who wants to say something first about Pulp Fiction?
In the interest of brevity, which Quentin Tarantino knows nothing about, I will yield my time.
I can say some things about Pulp Fiction. I enjoyed Tarantino to an extent. Craig's leaving, which he said he was going to do. But Tarantino, I mean, he's a brilliant writer. He's edgy. He's gritty. One thing that will always stick with this movie is Christopher Walken's watch monologue. You have an actor of that caliber come in for one scene and just deliver and destroy. I mean, it really sticks with me. But on the flip side, the performances were excellent. Three of the main actors were nominated. Samuel L. Jackson, John Travolta, in which they're calling this his comeback role, and Uma Thurman. So all three of those got nominated. And just the weaving of the storytelling was just from the mind of Tarantino. And, you know, only a man of that craft and ingenuity can – perform something like that. So
I can say actually a lot of the movies of 1994 were ruined by my peers. They were elevated to the heavens before I actually saw them. So Pulp Fiction was one of those that by the time I got around to it, for me, Jackie Brown is my favorite Tarantino film by a mile. And Pulp Fiction never connected with me in that way. I was more invested in the soundtrack than I ever was the actual film. But yeah, there's no denying that this was ground zero for a number of hacks. not respecting how talented Tarantino was, with his writing and with his story construction. And everybody seemed to think that all you had to do to make a story interesting was air it in, you know, spill it onto the floor like a puzzle and just film it in this weird order. The craft involved with the construction of that film, even today, I think is overrated because so many people tried to do it afterward and it sort of diminished its initial power.
Yeah, I see. I'm probably, Phil, like, we didn't go to the same high school, but if we did, I probably would have been one of those people that ruined Pulp Fiction for you. Because I saw it in the theater before. I mean, I had heard enough about it, but nobody I knew had seen it. And this, to me, is one of the more like game-changing moments in my journey as a film fan, because I had never seen anything like this movie. And I think you can say what you want about Tarantino. You can like him, you can hate him, you can think a lot about him as a person, and Lord knows I do. That's a whole different podcast. But I think one thing that you can't take away from him is his originality as a filmmaker. And that's, I think, one of the things that this film does is that, yes, he borrows from a lot of genres and a lot of different, you know, style choices. But there's such a unique spin on it through his, as you said, Ryan, is his writing and his use of soundtrack that, and as you mentioned, Phil, there are so many Pulp Fiction clones the rest of the decade. And it would take a while before you'd actually get some good ones. It took like 5 years. Cause I say to this day, Fight Club doesn't get made if Pulp Fiction's not a hit.
No.
100%. And both of those posters could be found on the dorm rooms of most, you know, white boys in college. So, those movies just kind of, you know, a lot of the stuff that happens later on happens because of a movie like Pulp Fiction, because not only is it like this big critical hit, it makes a ton of money. It's one of the highest grossing films of the year. It's in the top 10. It makes over $100 million. It makes almost 300 worldwide. So it's like, hey, here's this independent film with these like kind of known stars, but not like huge stars other than Bruce Willis, John Travolta making his comeback, and this really like nonlinear storytelling and all of this different, choices that he's making that just weren't being done at the time and then would be done in perpetuity.
Yeah, he's interesting. Like, he's very clearly a sort of postmodern filmmaker. And I always find it interesting that people who accuse Quentin Tarantino of being sort of a copycat and the guy who pulls all these things from different predecessors. And I want to go, you realize when George Lucas was designing the final run on the Death Star in 1977, he actually edited it with old war films before they actually made it. So, I mean, they both have a similar way of pulling from their old inspirations. And I don't think either of them deserves criticism for doing that.
No, and like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you could look at shot-by-shot comparisons that Spielberg uses from old serials. There's whole videos that show, you know, he's literally borrowing from the past in the films that he dug as a child. The difference being that Lucas and Spielberg grew up watching like serials and the
Hays Code stuff.
Hey, you're right. And Tarantino grew up watching the 70s blaxploitation movies and the violent stuff of that. So like, yeah, I'm never opposed to directors being inspired by what came before them. And what the question is do you do something unique with it? And I don't think you can argue that he certainly does.
Yeah.
Aaron, how about your thoughts on Pulp Fiction?
I think it's a great movie. I see people's problem with Tarantino. I don't particularly have a problem with him, but I totally see he's super quirky, super weird, super, you know, he's just, but I think the guy's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. You cannot argue with his storytelling and his creativity. I also think it's actually super wild that he wrote both Pulp Fiction and Natural Born Killers that both came out in the same year.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, it's really a breakout year for him in both regards. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. And Tarantino himself becomes like the next big like rock star director. Just almost kind of, you know, Reservoir Dogs was 2 years before this and he'd made a little bit of noise. But man, like you could argue he's the biggest star to come out of Pulp Fiction. And he's just kind of everywhere for a minute. And yeah, it gets nominated for a bunch of Oscars. It loses to Forrest Gump in most of them, except for best, it wins best original screenplay. So yeah, it's just this kind of moment. And little known fact, it is actually, our correspondent Scott McFarlane's favorite movie. People don't know that. Big Tarantino fan, that guy.
He's going to burn your house down.
I bring it. I like it. So anyway, well, that's, you know, he's not on, so we get to say stuff like that.
Nice knowing you.
All right. So moving on, there's a third movie, the third movie that we're going to talk about. And I think these are like the real kind of the biggest three movies to talk about in terms of critical acclaim. While Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction are taking up all the airspace, there's another movie that comes out in September and makes $16 million at the box office, but it gets seven Academy Award nominations and later on would go on to be IMDb's highest rated movie, and that is The Shawshank Redemption. And I think this is one of those things that if you go back and, you know, there's always these talks about if you relitigate like best picture nominees and what should have won or what would we vote on if they were held today? I think Shawshank probably wins best picture this year.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So
in a walk.
Yeah. Because it's way more mainstream than Pulp Fiction. It's less problematic than Forrest Gump. I think it's held up better over the years. And you know, it's just got a lot of stuff going for it. So, I'll start off with Shawshank Redemption. I think the funny thing about Shawshank Redemption that was put in my article is that a lot of people probably don't realize, as you say, you pointed this out earlier, Aaron, of all the movies that you wouldn't think were in 1994, this is the one because no one saw this movie in the theater.
Nobody. Like, nobody.
This is a movie that 100% owes its popularity to the video market.
And TBS.
And TBS, yes. Where it's probably airing right now. If you turn on our TV.
Somewhere Shawshank Redemption is playing on a cable channel.
Nuclear Holocaust will come and there will be nothing but replays of the Shawshank Redemption and reruns of Full House.
Yes.
That's what we'll be left with. But so what do we think? What's the reason for that? What about Shawshank Redemption has made it such an endearing piece 25 years later?
There are just certain films that you really wish that the Academy had ensemble awards for, much like the SAG Awards do.
Yes.
You know, Spotlight felt that way a couple of years back. Did it deserve to win Best Picture? Maybe, maybe not. But man, that ensemble cast was incredible. And that's very true of Shawshank Redemption. It's very true of a film like Saving Private Ryan. You know, there's certain films that come out where everybody just comes to play in such a perfect way. The casting is done so well, and there really is no, there's no drag on the performance by anyone. And that's what Shawshank Redemption is. And you get this, this tale of, I mean, it's right there in the title, obviously, a redemption tale. But, you know, it's just a very interesting piece that comes to life. And it's done in such a great way by these actors all up and down the board that I think that's why it remains to this day. And, of course, any film that has Morgan Freeman in it, that he gets to narrate it, already gets a bump up in the IMDb rankings. But truly, it's just a really well-written film and a good piece. And it doesn't necessarily need to fit in that 1994 mold. And it doesn't – it's more of a timeless piece in a way, I guess, because it wasn't such a – oh, obviously this is a 90s film when you go back and watch it today. It is a bit more timeless than the others.
Yeah, it actually feels like it came decades before. Mm-hmm. Like I could see this being an early 70s, late 60s movie. Mm. It has that kind of feel. The interesting thing for me is this was one of the major shifts in people's impressions of Stephen King. I there are still people today who are figuring out, wait, Shawshank is a Stephen King? Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And people who had been reading him for a time knew he could step out, you know, with Stand By Me. He could step out of this blockbuster horror corner that he had earned. and do some really thoughtful, humanist stories. And I think I think it was a turning point for him being, more than just a horror guy, and almost the start of him becoming the cultural figure, the ambassador, that he's become over the past 20, 25 years.
To go along with what everyone's saying, this is a movie that is essentially timeless. I mean, it's a prison story, and it holds up, but like Craig had said, an ensemble cast. I mean, you've got, Clancy Brown, who always makes a great villain, Tim Robbins and, Morgan Freeman, their chemistry is what makes the film. But it is superbly written. I mean, get busy living, get busy dying. Some of the messages in this film are really, deep and heartfelt once you think about it. And the fact that it came from Stephen King, the 94-page story, and it's all written from Red's, he's basically giving his final testimony about why he wants to leave. But the fact that they can take a 94-page story and expand it into such a great film is excellent. I think the best acting I've ever seen on film is Morgan Freeman delivering his final parole. I was moved by that monologue from him. So, I mean, everything about this movie is just the cinematography, like when Tommy gets shot and how the Clancy Brown goes back from the shadows. I mean, everything is just so good.
Yeah, I guess just to build on that, and obviously, I guess we're all singing the praises. Like it's unanimous. We are, unless someone's going to come in and talk about how much they hate it. I think that to everyone's point, like Forrest Gump, right? It's building up. It's not necessarily a time. It's a period piece, but at the same time, it wouldn't hold up today because that changes the events by 25 years. So everything that Forrest Gump experiences completely changes, which gives you a completely different movie. But this just stays in 1947 and the years following. So it is, it's a time capsule, which is why it holds up, because you could make it now and everything would be the same in 1947. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, the friendship between, the relationship between, I don't, there's like that haunting coolness about Andy Dufresne as a character in jail, where I think a lot of the, I feel like the 90s really started to build up a lot of the action movies, right? Everything started getting really fast paced and the special effects started getting more. And this, the pace just remains. This was the pace of that whole movie.
It's a story.
It never changes. Mm-hmm. It never, the tempo never really speeds up that much. The soundtrack is haunting. Thomas Newman does some haunting pieces in almost all the movies he does. And I, you know, that's another one you kind of remember. And to your point, it's like those movies, like when Brooks kills himself, when Morgan Freeman delivers his speech, when Andy's, you know, kicking rocks around the yard, like these are all scenes that stick out to you. Everyone can pick them out. It just holds up. It's just so good. And again, to the point of if it's on TV, if I've got to pick between Forrest Gump and Shawshank Redemption on TV, on TNT and TBS, Shawshank's winning.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. That's just, it is just a beautifully shot movie. It's beautifully acted. It's just, it's one of those, and it's interesting because I think this is of those three films, it's the movie that's gained the most in popularity, but then now because of it in more recent years, they've had this, there's a little undercurrent of backlash to be like, well, it's not really that great. And it's like, I fall somewhere in between it being the greatest movie of all time and trash. I don't think that's a, you know, hot take there.
He's our host.
Thank you. But
and he's here for the next 3 hours of this podcast.
The last thing I'll say before we move on it, it's interesting because we talk a lot about in the article about how 1999 gets informed by a lot of the stuff that happens in 1994. Mm. One of the biggest movies of 1999 is The Green Mile, which is directed by Frank Darabont.
Yep.
It is a Stephen King adaptation starring Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
So it's like Forrest Gump and Shawshank Redemption had a baby and it became The Green Mile. So, you know,
Shawshank Gump.
Yeah. Hanks turned down Tim Robbins' role in Shawshank Redemption.
Or Forrest Gump. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone made good choices, I think. But it is interesting. I wonder if Tom Hanks takes Shawshank Redemption, does Shawshank Redemption actually win Best Picture? Does it get more acclaim because Tom Hanks is a bigger star at the time than Tim Robbins?
You're right.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Zemeckis is a block, but I just think the money backing the movie was never going to change. It's sure. Zemeckis, and they would have gotten someone of Hanks's stature. Maybe the best actor win the year before helped, but Forrest Gump was a big budget drama that was going to have the backing of the studio behind it. And I think unless the lead performance became something like completely untenable, I think it was just going to get pushed more than a prison drama from a Stephen King novel. Come on.
It was highly marketed. I never heard anything about Shawshank Redemption.
Here's the thing, too, is we've talked about three Best Picture nominations, and every pair was nominated for Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor. You've got John Travolta, Best Actor, Samuel L. Jackson, Supporting. You've got Tom Hanks, Best Actor, Gary Sinise, Supporting. Morgan Freeman, Best Actor, no Tim Robbins. Mm-hmm. So, which I think is a huge slap to the face. So.
Let's move away from the best pictures because we've got two other nominees, but I think we'll circle back around to them because I think let's move away from the highfalutin Oscar bait. And let's talk about a guy talking out of his butt. Because I'm
sitting right here, Lou.
that's the tagline for the Front Row Podcast. Talking out of our butts since 2018 or what? But yeah, this I think if from a movie standpoint, the breakout of Jim Carrey is one of the big headlines of 1994. Mm-hmm. And I think Aaron, you said this earlier, or maybe it was Craig. To know if you didn't grow up in the time, you'd be forgiven for not realizing that all three of these movies came out in the same year. Mm-hmm. But for like to live through that period where, oh, here's Ace Ventura that comes out in February, and it's like, oh, hey, the dude from In Living Color got his own movie. Good for him.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, you know what? It was actually kind of good. And then it becomes a hit. And then The Mask comes out in the summer. Mm-hmm. And it's an even bigger hit. And then Dumb and Dumber comes out in December and it's an even bigger, like he just like keeps increasing on himself. And by the end of the year, he's the biggest star in the world. It's kind of crazy to think how that all shifts in like within a 10 month span.
Yeah. I mean, I would, I think that there's someone else that has a movie that stays with us in 1994 that I would argue is a bigger star at this time. But
we'll talk about Keanu in a minute. That's okay.
But Jim Carrey, I mean, he can do all the crazy things that he wants to do now because of this year. I mean, he has like 12 mansions due to 1994. And he really does bring in – he becomes the comedy face of the 90s in this year. And we have some great comedians in the 90s, but tops on that list is Jim Carrey. And he brings in three characters that – in a comedy, you can easily cut and paste the characters along, but he does bring a decent amount of acting to each of these. And I know that that sounds funny in talking about Dumb and Dumber in particular, but to me, he does a very good job of differentiating these characters. And that's why they hit the pop culture zeitgeist so much, because it was just three completely separate and different films for him.
Absolutely. And what makes a great comedy is quotability in my mind and memorable scenes. And each three of these movies has memorable scenes and very quotable dialogue. Harry, you're alive and a horrible shot. I mean, some of these things, I mean, just the physical humor that he does as well, from The Mask to Dumb and Dumber and Ace Ventura. I mean, it's just nuts, whether it's talking out of your butt or sitting there acting like you're going to vomit after seeing your best friend with your girl. I mean, it's just, he can do it at the drop of a hat. I mean, he's back 94 and he still is.
Yeah. So of the three that we're talking about here, what do you think in 25 years later, what do you think is the one that sticks out to you the most and that holds up the best after 25 years later? What do you think, Aaron? The Mask. Yeah.
I think The Mask is Jim Carrey at his peak.
Mm-hmm.
Talent, performance, getting the most out of what makes him unique.
Yeah. I'm really surprised that someone else jumped in and said The Mask. I go to The Mask because I love that superhero film. And in a way, this is like the first anti-hero superhero movie that we get. And Dumb and Dumber, I think, as far as cultural relevance, I think that's what, you know, when the obituary is written, it'll say Dumb and Dumber. I don't know that it'll mention the Mask. But for me, out of these three films, The Mask is the one that I would still go back. Like, if you give me the choice between these three movies, I'm watching The Mask, hands down.
For me, you know, as an 8-year-old living in 94, it was The Mask. But as an adult, Dumb and Dumber, it's just, there's more quotability. I mean, situational humor. To me, it's just, I laugh more watching that movie than the other two. I can just go on for days and just quote that movie, but I'm not going to.
I know The Mask gets sort of lumped in with a Jim Carrey comedy, but it's a dark, it's a very dark film. And I think that's one of the things that, one of the gifts of Jim Carrey that I think still hasn't really been capitalized on to the fullest is there's a darkness to him that he was able to use in The Mask that you don't see it in those other performances. The whole point of the movie is him sort of moving away from The Mask. The Mask brings out the worst parts of him, even though he's, you know, he's turns into this quote unquote romantic. He's really a lech and, you know, kind of an awful sort of toxic masculinity personified. And there's just a darkness to it that he hasn't, no one else has tapped into it besides, I think, that film.
I think The Mask really shows his acting chops. I mean, he goes from a doormat to a zany character to someone who's finally standing up for himself. Right. Out of these three, he's not playing a character. He's playing a person who gets extraordinary gifts.
All right, Aaron, any thoughts on the year of Jim Carrey?
12-year-old me would have picked Ace Ventura.
Yeah, no.
37-year-old me picks Dumb and Dumber. And The Mask falls somewhere in between.
I still remember that Dolphins field goal kicker that screwed it all up for them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Laces out.
Laces out.
Well, I've learned something from this podcast today, and that's apparently I need to go back and revisit The Mask.
I do. I guess I do, too.
Because I remember thinking at the time, and again, this is, you know, maybe what appealed to 14 or 15-year-old me, you know, the more the more crass humor of the other two really standing out to me. And I've never actually gone back and revisited it. So I would probably say between Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber, it would be Dumb and Dumber. And I think what helps in that is not necessarily just Jim Carrey, but Jeff Daniels, who gives a great performance.
Their dynamic is awesome.
Mm-hmm. He has somebody to work off of in that movie, as opposed to Ace Ventura, where it's just everybody reacting to him.
Right.
So his shtick is less, I think, obnoxious than in Ace Ventura, which, don't get me wrong, I watched the crap out of Ace Ventura. I wasn't above it. But I think that's the thing. And the Farrelly brothers too, who end up a year later, they do Kingpin. And then a couple of years later, they do There's Something About Mary, which becomes like this ginormous hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this gives them kind of a breakout moment as well. So I really think Dumb and Dumber holds up well, but apparently I got to go back and revisit The Mask.
Ace Ventura, looking back on it, feels very, in Living Color. Like, it's just one of his
one character.
It's just him in a big long improv skit. Whereas, yes, Dumb and Dumber, there's a dynamic, and then, yeah, I guess I got to go back and watch The Mask.
talk about range, by the way. Jeff Daniels comes off of being Joshua Chamberlain in the Gettysburg movie, and then going right off the set of Dumb and Dumber. But I will say, Lou, that if you're looking for a guilty pleasure anytime, look up Son of the Mask.
That'd be the best if
you want to go there.
Jamie Kennedy is banned from my podcast. I did Malibu's Most Wanted, and I am done, good sir.
No more.
Good day.
I was just listening to the Pop Culture Draft Night, and I can't remember who it was on the podcast that was saying, was it your wife, Phil, that was saying that having to watch Malibu's Most Wanted was the worst experience of her life or something?
Oh yeah. It broke her. No, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding.
Anyway, sorry for the tangent, but
no, that's fine. Just to put a bow on this. So ultimately Jim Carrey has all three movies end up in the top. The lowest of grossing is Ace Ventura, which is 16 on the list for the year at 72 million. And then The Mask makes 119 million. It ends up in ninth place, and Dumb and Dumber ends up in sixth place with 127 million. So all like, just again, you, a guy who really kind of owns that year and ends up owning, the decade, now owns a lot of stuff because he's filthy rich. So Craig, you talked about what you thought was a bigger breakout in 1994. Eagerly await this. Who's your breakout of 1994?
Well, not breakout. I think you said largest, or, you know, like most popular actor or something like that. And I would say that distinction goes to Tim Allen.
We're done. We're done here. Shut it down. Shut it down.
Listen to me.
Okay. Okay.
Because I found this out when we did our Santa Claus podcast. In for a couple of weeks in 1994, Tim Allen had the highest rated TV show on television. He had the number one film at the box office, and he had the number one New York Times bestseller. So not many people have done that feat. In fact, I don't know if anybody else has.
I need a much stiffer drink for that fact.
So I will say that just, you said, I think, in that year that Jim Carrey became the biggest superstar of that year. I would say that one Mr. Santa Claus disagrees with you. That's all.
Well, look, Tim Allen, I was not expecting a Tim Allen literary digression, but I'm glad we had it. But you do bring up the Santa Claus, which is a big hit that year. It's the fourth highest grossing movie of the year. And it caps off a really interesting year for Disney, which is another thing, about this year is I think this is a year that has something for everybody. So let's talk about what there was there for the kids, for family. And of course, you got to start with Disney. So Craig, I'll let you start and tell us about the year, in the 1994 that Disney had.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that the landmark film, of course, is The Lion King. And, you know, Beauty and the Beast had just come off being the first animated film ever nominated for Best Picture. And I think that looking back at those two films, Lion King is not nominated for Best Picture. We didn't talk about the other two nominees, but I think that Quiz Show and Four Weddings and a Funeral, I think both of those films deserve that spot. And I can always argue that an animated film should be nominated for Best Picture because it takes so much more time than a live action film to actually create and then bring to the screen. But I can understand why this version of Hamlet didn't go to the Best Picture nomination. But obviously, staying power is so strong with that film. We're going to be doing Beyond the Mouse. We'll be tackling it here in July. With the new pseudo live action. I know people are worried with the word live action in a CGI film, but Lion King is pinnacle Michael Eisner Disney. That Disney renaissance is fully realized, and Disney is starting to essentially run the world at that point. And so you also had the live action, like the Santa Claus, and you've got also some other smaller projects that are in the works. One of my favorite films doesn't come out till the next year, but a lot of the finishing touches on the Goofy movie are put on in 1994. Just a really stellar year for animation and for Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg over at Disney.
So there's two other movies that Disney does that year. Obviously, yeah, Lion King's the big one. It's the second highest grossing movie of the year at $312 million. Santa Claus is number four at 144. But they have two other movies that do really well, too. They have making about $50 million, which is pretty respectable for 1994. In 26th is Angels in the Outfield.
Uh-huh.
And then they also have a couple notches down there. At number 30 is The Mighty Ducks, D2, the sequel. So they have four movies there that all do really well. And they're all kind of, you know, you've got a comedy, you've got an animation, you've got a live action Christmas movie, and two sports movies. So it's an interesting year for Disney. So let's talk about the year in Disney for 1994, Lion King or anything else. Aaron, what are your thoughts on Disney's 1994?
As I've said, I was 12. So like when my parents were choosing, when we were barking in their ear about what movies to see, it wasn't, you know, we weren't dying to go see Forrest Gump or Shawshank Redemption. We were like, we're going, you know, they were taking us to Lion King. So we saw that opening weekend. We went and saw Santa Claus in the theater. We saw D2. We were a big hockey family. So those were obviously very nostalgic for me. I've got a 4-year-old, so Lion King is playing all the time in the house. And is this, Craig, help me. Is this the first time Disney kills a father? Is Lion King?
Oh,
they kill the mother and Bambi.
There's a lot of...
They kill all the moms. All the moms are dead in Disney up until, I think, Lion King.
It would definitely be the first on-screen death of a father. I mean, there are some like orphan stories and orphan tales, you know. But Mufasa's death scene is gut-wrenching. I mean, it's honestly, Mufasa's death scene is the reason why I don't know if I'll take my 3.5-year-old to see the new Lion King, because I don't know how that's going
to
impact that. You know, I don't know. We kind of skip over that scene.
I was 8 and I'm still messed up about it. I don't know if I'm ready to watch the live action.
Totally. Right. So it has a huge impact. And what's funny is that we all saw this as, you know, young adults and kids, and it impacted us then. And now we're of the age that they're rebooting it. And we're like, oh my gosh, how is it going to, it's like still impacting us because we're worried about how our kids are going to take it.
Mm.
So it's kind of funny that it is, oh my God, the circle of life. Here it is.
Oh, man, someone should write a song about that.
I know. Disney's still obviously thriving. I guess in 1994 is no different. I'm no Craig, so I can't really comment too much on all the Disney stuff, but seems like a good year for Disney in 1994.
Here's my odd contribution to this portion. Mm-hmm. Disney had an odd fixation with death this year. Because you have the Lion King.
Oh my God, they killed Santa.
And then they kill Santa.
He
falls off a roof. And then the other one, Angels in the Outfield, is all about dead baseball players.
Oh my God.
It's all about dead people, yeah.
You're right.
I mean, if, you know,
Amsak in Disney that year.
Exactly. Like, someone was processing some stuff.
Yeah.
Michael Eisner was processing some stuff in the early 90s.
Well, this is when, I mean, it really is that time, because Jeffrey Katzenberg would leave the studio not too long after Lion King to start DreamWorks with Steven Spielberg. And so it is the time where it was an embarrassment of riches for them, kind of coming off of Little Mermaid and then to Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. And so this is kind of that last real true pinnacle animated film in that Disney renaissance. Hunchback of Notre Dame is an amazing film, but it never reaches the type of acclaim that these films got. And then after that, you know, Katzenberg's gone to work at DreamWorks. And so this is kind of the last hurrah of all of this creative power going in and becoming just a dominant force at the box office as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right. They kind of sleep after this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Phil or Ryan, you got any thoughts on the year of Disney?
The one thing I will say is I had a Twitter conversation with, I don't know if any of you guys read Film Crit Hulk. He's a film critic who writes, he's been around for a while, but he writes criticism as the Hulk. So he wrote movies as the Hulk. Really smart guy and knows movies in a way that I don't think I ever will. But one of the things he said to me, I can't remember what movie we were talking about, but I had a similar question about taking my daughter to a movie that I thought might upset her. It may have been like Toy Story 3 or something like that. And one of the things that he told me, I'll never forget this, he said, movies are a chance for kids to learn how to process difficult emotions in a safe space. Mm-hmm. Because they are not, you know, they're in a place where they can talk them through with you. And my daughter, there have been movies that, you know, that have upset her and that we've been able to talk through. And I think now 3 years old in Lion King, I'm not going to go that far, but I will say that, I mean, that's one of the things that Disney films have given me is, you know, sometimes they present difficult stuff and it generates conversation with your kids that I think has a lot of value.
I was just going to say what's a real bummer this for 1994 for Lion King is that there was no animated best picture. So Lion King really lost out in that aspect. But Disney had a great year. D2, I'm a big hockey fan. So, I mean, that's a real fun movie.
Everything you guys say, I agree with. And I think, yeah, Lion King stands as an all-time great Disney movie. So that's, again, another reason I think 94 is such a great year is because you have this, like, pinnacle of you know, animation. It's one of the best, I think, animated films of all time. But Disney does, you know, they kind of have an interesting slate of movies this year that all do really well. I'll leave it with this. My story about D2, it came out in March, and that was right around the previous Oscar season. So a lot of times at that age, my parents trusted me enough to go to my own movie while they saw something that they wanted to see. Mm-hmm. So I went to see D2 and my movie ended before their movie. So I had to go in and watch the second half of the movie they were watching.
Oh geez. What was it?
Schindler's List.
Oh no. That happened to me with Braveheart. We can do that in a 1995 podcast, but I saw Casper and then had to go in and Braveheart at the end. Oh, and I was like mortified.
Yeah.
Power Rangers and Titanic. I literally saw the part of Titanic you wouldn't want a kid to see. In Titanic.
Oh my gosh.
Power Rangers got out. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Oh, I love that we all have one.
Oh, we are. Like, we all love that. Yeah. No, within 20 minutes, I went from Emilio Estevez singing We Are the Champions to the Holocaust.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, yeah. That's so great. Yay, parenting.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Anyway, all right, moving away from Disney. So Lion King comes out in the summer, and let's talk about summer movies real quick, because we've talked about a lot of the summer movies that came out that year already. Forrest Gump's a summer movie, The Mask is a summer movie, Lion King's a summer movie, but there's a couple of other big ones that come out, and that'll get us to maybe the year in action movies. So there's three big ones in that year. We have Clear and Present Danger, which is, mm-hmm. Another, Jack Ryan film starring Harrison Ford. We have True Lies, which is, Arnold Schwarzenegger and James Cameron. It's the first film to cost over $100 million to make, and it ends up making well over that. And then we have Speed.
Lou's favorite movie.
So good.
I'll own it. I'm fine. You know what?
Right,
so let's talk about those movies. We'll talk about those three. I think and I'll start because I think of the three, Speed is the one that has stayed in the cultural conversation. I think True Lies it was the biggest hit of those three, but it's the one I think that gets probably referenced or remembered the least. But Speed, again, if you want a great summer action movie, you don't get much better than Speed. It's so good. And everything about it works. And I know we talked about this on Summer Blockbuster, so I won't belabor that point, but yeah, like Speed was a movie that was supposed to come out in the spring. It was supposed to be like a February, March release, but it tested so well.
Mm.
Like the studio didn't even know how good of a movie they had on their hands. It tested so well that they was like, oh, we should move this to the summer. And they did. And it makes a ton of money. It's the eighth highest grossing film of the year. Clear and Present Danger is number 7. True Lies is number 3. So all of these movies do particularly well. We also have a couple of other things that we'll talk to, but let's talk about the summer of 94. Especially maybe Phil, if this was your movie going peak like it was mine, were you seeing a lot of movies on your own in the summer, or what was catching your eye in the summer of 94?
Well, Speed, this was the heyday of HBO first looks and making of, and Speed was one. I must have watched the making of Speed, I'm not kidding, like 20 times. Because, I mean, you're essentially just watching, hey, let's watch these guys do stunts for a half hour and sell this really exciting film. So Speed was my speed for that summer. One of the things that I wanted to stress, Mark Mancina's score for Speed is maybe one of the greatest action scores of all time.
It really is just
like the film. It's so economical. I mean, it's just streamlined, and it's the heartbeat of that film. I mean, if you took it out and you were just sort of watching a bus, like, you can't even imagine how
that would be. I'm picturing it right now.
Right, but there's something about that score that just propelled everything, and it all led to this big orchestral swell when Keanu and Sandra Bullock drop out of the bottom of the bus. And there's this one moment in the score that's completely different from the rest, because it breathes, and it's this wonderful, wonderful moment. And I had the cassette tape of that score, and I burnt that thing to the ground. It may have been one of the first ones that I just straight up melted, because I played it so often. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a clean, sharp, economical film. And if there's one great mystery of that, is like, did someone save this film from Jan de Bont, or did Jan de Bont just, like, this was what he had, and then the mojo just went poof? Because everything he made after this is, like, not just it is hacky as hell.
I will go to bat for Twister, my friend.
Yeah,
I'm with you, Lou. I like Twister too.
Was Twister before this?
No, Twister is after this. He got to do Twister because of this.
Okay, I'll give him a pass on Twister. but then you go to The Haunting, and like, he only made like five films. Like,
he did Speed 2.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know what? I'd be remiss to the, you know, because especially with Speed, obviously Keanu Reeves becomes a much bigger star because of this movie, but Sandra Bullock also has a breakout performance in this.
Yep.
She's like, that's the thing I think that makes this movie work. And to, again, we talked about this a little bit on the Summer Blockbuster Bracket podcast. But one of the things that makes this movie work is that these are just two incredibly charismatic movie stars who have just bonkers chemistry with each other. So their interactions are so good. And like, the premise is so tight and simple, and everyone just sells it. And the movie doesn't let you breathe to think about it. And that's exactly what an action movie should do. Because if you think about any action movie for more than 5 seconds, it all falls apart. But she is so good in it. He's great in it. The action's great. The other breakout performance we didn't mention when we talked about The Mask is also the debut of Cameron Diaz. Mm-hmm. So she has a breakout year that year. Sandra Bullock has a breakout year. Jim Carrey, there's a couple others we're going to get to.
Courtney Cox has a breakout year with Ace Ventura.
Yeah. And then later that year, Friends debuts.
Right.
So she becomes a big star. There's a couple others we'll get to, but yeah, I think of those three, I haven't seen True Lies in a long time, or Clear and Present Danger. So of those three, I think Speed's the one that holds up. But any thoughts about the action movies of 1994?
I love True Lies. I think the amount of comedy that's rolled in with the action is great. Whether it's him talking to a horse, or Jamie Lee Curtis falling down as she's doing a striptease, or when Tom Arnold gets shot at and he makes sure that his jewels are there. There's so many different comedic moments in True Lies wrapped in the action of a James Cameron, Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. Really well done. You know, him trying to get the terrorists and everything. Speed, though, we did not talk about Dennis Hopper. He made the movie. Heck of a villain. But True Lies, out of the three, I remember watching True Lies and Speed on VHS, going to Blockbuster to pick them up. I think I owned Speed, so, but yeah, I watched the heck out of those two.
Yeah, I think I watched all three of them quite a bit, mainly because my dad is huge into Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a character that still endures definitely through a lot of iterations between, you know, going from a Baldwin to going to Harrison Ford and then going into Ben Affleck for a day and then now with John Krasinski.
Chris Pine.
Chris Pine.
Oh, and Chris Pine. Oh, my goodness.
For a day.
Chris Pine. I saw that. I saw that in the movie theaters too with my dad. But yeah, no, Clear and Present Danger was a wonderful film. I'll say that I think True Lies, the reason why it worked so well was because of the it kind of took that spy story and tilted it on its head to like make it into this family man. And Jamie Lee Curtis made that movie for me.
It's
not at all about Arnold Schwarzenegger in that movie. But
yeah, she's pretty great.
She was so fantastic in that film. But lots of really great action in 94. And glad that we have them because now I can go back and binge them whatever I want.
Yeah, not to bring in everybody down, but I can't even watch True Lies anymore because I know Eliza Dushku as a 16-year-old suffered some pretty nasty stuff at the hands of a stuntman on that film.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hard to watch a film when you know that kind of stuff happened.
Yeah, that movie to me, I think in a lot of ways, that's the one that I think kind of gets relegated to the past and is probably okay to be there. Because I remember even at the time, the movie took a lot of hits for its portrayal of kind of Muslim. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I would be interested to see Clear and Present Danger now. I don't think I'd be interested to go back to True Lies for a lot of that stuff. And, you know, obviously James Cameron's not maybe the greatest human being alive ever either. So there's a lot of stuff, but it really was at the time kind of this template for what a big budget 90s action movie looked like. But it's interesting that 25 years later, it's the little more low budget, more economical Speed that we all kind of gravitate towards has aged remarkably well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As probably the biggest Harrison Ford stan in the world. I like, give me self-righteous Harrison Ford pointing his finger at people. Patriot Games is an all timer for me.
Patriot Games is the best of that series.
Yeah,
in my mind.
And Clear and Present Danger. The thing about Patriot Games is it was based on these people coming after his family. Clear and Present Danger is more of a just straight spy movie. And I think losing that, it took something away that Patriot Games had. That being said, I remember the last time I watched it going, I may have underestimated how good and smart this film really is. And that's about the time that Tom Clancy had his, all my books are 400 pages to all my books are 1100 pages.
Yeah.
So anytime you can take one of those books and, you know, strip it for parts and put it back together for a movie, I think they're really, really sharp stories that these two were the best examples of a good Tom Clancy, of two good Tom Clancy films.
All right, let's move on to a different change gears just a little bit, because when you think of the 90s, a lot of times you especially the early 90s, we talk about Kurt Cobain passing away that year, and he was kind of the leader of Gen X and the Gen X movement, and he was kind of the embodiment of that. This tends also 1994 tends to be a big year for Gen X films and movies that spoke to that generation. We have kind of smaller successes like PCU, which I think is a weird cult movie that most people who were not like alive in 94 have seen, have gone back to. But then you have Reality Bites, you have The Crow, and then you have probably the biggest of those movies that's held up more, and that's Kevin Smith's Clerks. So let's just talk about the year in 1994 for the Gen X crowd. Any memories particularly or anything that you want to say about any of those movies?
I just revisited Clerks yesterday because we are planning on finally, you know, Kevin Smith was a huge inspiration for finally getting this podcast off the ground a long time ago. And so this summer we're going to be, Jeremy and I are going to be revisiting five of his films leading up to Jay and Silent Bob reboot. But Clerks to me is such a unique story because this film is made basically on the back of a credit card for about $27,000 to $30,000, depending on which website you look at and what you what you go by. It made $30 million and just completely blew up Kevin Smith's career. And I mean, he's able to make these kind of off the wall, zany, most people hate them kind of films because of what he did with Clerks and starting that whole going into Mallrats and Chasing Amy and Dogma and all of that. Just a really interesting movie. And our friend Jeremy Bailey with another podcast here locally always says that you have more technology in your iPhone than Kevin Smith did to shoot Clerks.
And, oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know, it's pretty incredible what he was able to do with that as basically a film student. And you know, does it hold up as well? Yeah, the language is definitely 90s. And it, you know, there's certain tidbits here and there that I was like, oh, I don't know about this. And I mean, I'm definitely more of a self-proclaimed Kevin Smith podcasting fan over his movies, but, I could see where that was able to catch fire and, glad that it's included in this list of great films.
I think where Pulp Fiction was the indie drama of the year, Clerks was definitely the indie comedy of the year. Again, it's all about writing, and Kevin Smith's writing really captured Gen X and really captured the 90s. You know, and from there, he makes a shared universe. I mean, you have the Jay and Silent Bob shared universe. He's gone on to make multiple films with a lot of the same characters, almost to the point like Tarantino did. Tarantino had the brand of cigarettes that features in a lot of movies. Kevin Smith has got the cow restaurant
movies.
So it's just phenomenal what he's able to do with, you know, given that $30,000 to make this small movie, and now he's exploded. The other movie that I really like for Gen X is just Reality Bites, and I like that because Ethan Hawke is one of my favorites, but I think it really captured what, you know, kids growing up were going through at that time. So Reality Bites is one of my favorites, definitely on my top 100.
Yeah, the thing about this year too with Pulp Fiction and with Clerks is this is the beginning of the sort of Miramax mythology.
Yeah, yeah.
This is where they really, you know, took hold as like this developer of indie talent and
right.
And finding these sort of out of the mainstream talents and creatives to elevate. You know, part of that was just good marketing, but I mean, The Crow is Miramax as well. So, I mean, these are, it's clear that they, you know, even while they were a big hype machine, there was plenty of, they earned their stripes. Mm-hmm. And I think 1994 was where people kind of went, oh, these guys are serious about what they're doing. Mm-hmm.
Clerks is clever, as are the majority. You know, I almost want to say, oh, is Clerks the most clever of Kevin Smith's films? No. I don't know, right? Okay, so see, mm-hmm. You say no. When I'm looking at the list, these four Gen X movies, to Lou's comment that the 80s was fluffy, I think what you get here in your teens, early 20s movies, where the 80s movies were fluffy, these are more of like your brooding Gen Xers. You know, you're like with Reality Bites. Like to me, Reality Bites is the Breakfast Club of the 90s, where you're getting into those relationships, those, and then PCU is the Animal House of the 90s to me. You know, it's like, this is what college life is like, you know, and it's zany and it's weird and it's fun and it's clever too. And it's a good time. But if you were going to make a college movie, right, in like, I don't think it would hold up even 10 years later, PCU. I mean, it's fun.
Right.
But like when we were in college, like our experience was already completely different.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so much had changed in the 90s by the time you got to the late 90s. Like the early 90s is such a time specific period that things do change. And I think some of that is like, you know, I've always said that there's a, you can look at the pop culture versus what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And in the early 90s, you had a Gulf War, you had a recession. Things were not great in the country at the time, economically speaking. Morale was kind of low. You had the riots in LA. You had lots of stuff going on. And so there's a cynicism that happens in Gen X. And if you look at all four of the movies, I think the through line is all through four of them have kind of cynical.
They're all brooding.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And then, like the late 90s, the economy's doing well again. Things like the internet boom happened. The late 90s, you got movies like 10 Things I Hate About You and She's All That, you know, those kind of, which is more like the upbeat.
They get peppy. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so, yeah, I think, which is why like a movie like PCU, I don't think, again, I like, unless you were born between like 1978 and 1983, you probably did not and have no need to see PCU, but aside from a kick-ass George Clinton concert, but, but it's interesting in that moment that there's that kind of thread. But like, you know, and The Crow has an interesting kind of history too. You can look at The Crow and as a, you know, it's a graphic novel adaptation at a time where really anything that wasn't Batman wasn't, you know, any comic book that didn't involve Batman wasn't getting made or doing well. And The Crow like took the darkness of the Tim Burton Batmans and kind of doubled down on that. And is like,
here's my question about The Crow. Does The Crow get as successful as it did if Brandon Lee doesn't die?
I think it does better.
Oh, okay.
I think it's mythology doesn't grow. Like I don't think it becomes the same thing, but it's sort of like, you know, Heath Ledger in the Joker. Like he died, but the performance was there and intact. There's weird stuff in The Crow. Like when you see him, you know, they essentially like photoshopped him out of one shot and put him in another shot. Like there's weird stuff going on there that I think if they had the full performance intact, they wouldn't have had to use some shortcuts that I think undermine some other stuff in the film. When you're concerned about just getting a film that is releasable, you aren't able to take some of the chances. And having seen, you know, the few movies that Brandon Lee made, that dude was a star.
He was great.
He was, you know, good looking, athletic, action star.
But he was a good actor. Like he had brain.
Yeah. And charming. And so, yeah, I think the box office would have been helped by having a full intact performance from him. Just from being able to complete a film the way a film is supposed to be complete.
Yeah, and I think there's also probably something too that if he's alive, he's able to do the press for it and his personality is able to come through and sell the movie a little bit. Like I think he becomes like a major heartthrob if he's
around to do that.
Because and the movie itself is really good and also the soundtrack is really good and those things don't change. I get what you're saying, Aaron, is I do think there's obviously some intrigue that gets caused like, oh, this dude died, you know, he died on set. And of course, like there's enough dumbass 13 or 14 year olds will say, oh, I hear they left it in the movie. You could see where it happened.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my question is legit rooted in curiosity and not in judgment. Like, I was like, oh, does it, you're everyone's opinion. Like, does it get more popular or does it help or hurt that he died?
Oh, yeah. Brandon Lee was ready to explode. Like this literally could have been his speed if he had made it through.
Yeah. Okay.
So we talk about the best picture nominees earlier, and so I want to circle back around to a couple of things, because there's one on here that I think's been kind of forgotten, and I'd like to offer a replacement. I think Quiz Show is a fine film. I've seen it a couple of times. It's really well done. It's got some very good performances, but to me, I think the biggest controversy of the year with the best picture was the omission of the film Hoop Dreams. Basketball documentary. So I don't know if anybody else has anything to say about Hoop Dreams, but I want to make sure that we talk about it, because it's not only considered one of the best sports movies of all time, it's considered one of the best documentaries, and it comes out this year. So any thoughts on either Quiz Show or Hoop Dreams?
Quiz Shows was good, but I think that the main thing that it had going for it was that it was a Robert Redford film. Other than that, I mean, there's not really much to it. I mean, nobody got nominated for the acting. It's the biopic of the year. Let's call it what it is. But Hoop Dreams, I mean, what they did and going down that rabbit hole of that kid's life and following him as close as they did was very ingenious and intuitive. I really learned a lot about filmmaking from that movie and in terms of documentary. So I think that's the first documentary that I actually sat down and actually watched as a kid. So.
Yeah, we're Midwestern people here, so I can only speak for myself, but I have a strong tie to Roger Ebert, and he was a big booster of this film. And this was about the time where he started to become kind of like a guiding light for me with movies, even when I didn't, agree with him wholeheartedly. This is one of those that I remember being sort of a flashpoint for a different type of film that I'd ever seen, a different way of telling a story, seeing people who I would not see in any other way. I think this was another one of those cases where the Oscars just have a lack of imagination. Lion King was not a Best Picture nominee, neither was this, and they're both on sort of outsider categories, one being a documentary, one being an animated film, and they both Hoop Dreams is one of those movies that that just sticks with you once you've seen it, especially if you see it. I saw it when I was 16, and it's unforgettable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the year it's funny, because I pointed this out in the article. This is a weird time where basketball was so popular that there were like three different basketball movies that year that all did fairly well. There's this, there's Blue Chips, which is about college basketball and has like a great Nick Nolte meltdown monologue at the end, which I love. And then there's Above the Rim, which I think is kind of an underrated movie about street ball. And it stars Tupac's in it. It's got a really great soundtrack. It's where the song Regulate comes from. But it's
welcome.
Yeah. It's an interesting choice, but yeah, I remember people being really up in arms over Hoop Dreams not getting nominated. But I think what you said, Ryan, is correct, that I think the prestige of a film like Quiz Show, does kind of like, because of the pedigree that's assigned to it.
There were controversies in what was nominated and what won the Oscars.
94 was a weird man.
Even in the 90s, Craig. Even in the 90s.
I'm so glad we don't have that anymore.
Crazy.
I just
the other day, I just watched Green Book, I just loved it. I loved every bit of it.
Yeah.
Four Weddings and a Funeral also, I mean, I think that just, hey, it's a comedy. Let's throw it in there.
It's a romantic comedy to get nominated for Best Picture. I mean, good on them. I mean,
why not?
That's not necessarily something that happens every other day. And Hugh Grant leads that cast, and it's another really great ensemble piece. I mean, it's a really solid film.
But save it for the ensemble and not the Best Picture, Hoop Dreams.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, that's why it'd be hard to have that category every year. You never know,
right?
Because there's so many individual solo performances. But I think the SAG Awards gets it right by awarding Best Ensemble.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up Four Weddings and a Funeral because it's the last Best Picture nominee we haven't talked about. But yeah, that hits a real sweet spot in terms of it being a romantic comedy, but it also being an independent film. Mm-hmm. Because it's released in, it's a British film. It costs like $3 million to make. It made, something bonkers like that. It makes $52 million in the States, but it makes a couple hundred million worldwide. And it's rare. It's a rare romantic comedy that gets nominated for Best Picture. So yeah, I think it's interesting. It's yet another breakout performance from 1994. Hugh Grant becomes a megastar out of it. And just like, you know, if you're looking at a slate of movies of a movie year, I think you'd look at, okay, well, what were romantic comedies like? And it was such an important genre in the 90s. And Four Weddings and a Funeral is one of the best of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
The last breakout year that we're going to talk about, in addition to Brad Pitt. He has a breakout year too with two films, Interview with the Vampire and Legends of the Fall. We'll touch on those real quickly because I don't know if they're going to rank up at this as the best of his resume necessarily, but just any thoughts on seeing those films and seeing Brad Pitt break out this year?
For me, Legends of the Fall was a very beautiful movie. It won Best Cinematography, but it really solidifies Brad Pitt as a serious actor. When he's acting with Aidan Quinn and more importantly, Anthony Hopkins, he really has a chance to show his depth, which he does in this film. You believe that he's a tough as nails rancher. But more importantly, on the horror front, Interview with the Vampire is probably the best vampire movie of the 90s besides Dracula. But it's hard to say. But his performance in Interview with the Vampire is so touching. And you don't think you would feel touching performance with a vampire, but he really comes across as a person who is damaged. And to be that type of actor that can show that range as a villain is incredible.
Mm-hmm. I have a confession to make here. I haven't seen Interview with a Vampire in a long time, and I was listening to something recently, and they said it was an allegory for AIDS, the AIDS epidemic.
Yep.
And I was like, man, that went right over my head.
Anne Rice wrote it.
I need to go back and watch it again.
Anne Rice wrote it in the 80s, but what's his name? Neil Jordan. He had it as an allegory for AIDS because Neil Jordan does that. So,
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just saying I've never seen it since I was a kid. So yeah. That to me was completely lost on me.
Oh, yeah.
But I'll have to go back and revisit it sometime. Legends of the Fall, I've actually never seen either. And
it's a World War I movie. It's great.
I like 15-year-old me had no use for movies where Brad Pitt's being dreamy.
I didn't see it until I was older.
So. I mean, for me, Brad Pitt's breakout role as a tween in the 90s was actually Cool World, which he did in 1994. I thought Brad Pitt way before everyone else thought he had this flowing hair. I thought he was great in the live action animated film.
I loved Legends of the Fall. Yeah, like you said, there aren't very many World War I movies, probably because it was a long slog and brutal in ways that aren't necessarily blood and guts, more like rotting corpses.
Yeah.
But back, I guess I'm the score guy. James Horner did the score for Legends of the Fall, and it's gorgeous.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Phil.
James Horner owned the movie score game in the 90s.
But yes. The score for Interview with the Vampire got nominated for Best Original Score. Just going to throw that out there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good
thing. I got to get horror some love.
Thanks, Veronica. Okay. Well, you mentioned horror, so let's, and I know you brought this up earlier, Ryan, in the off chat. Let's talk a little bit about a couple, because I don't know if this is if there's a criticism I'll make of this year, 94, is maybe it's not the best year for horror, but we've got a couple that you wanted to talk about, Ryan, so go ahead.
Really, when it comes down to horror, you have Wes Craven's New Nightmare. That is probably the biggest one. It is the last one of the Nightmare on Elm Streets before he comes back with Freddy versus Jason and that terrible remake. But when you have Wes Craven coming back to do something that he started in the 80s and going full meta, because he did go meta with this film, to do this in 94 and then do it again in 99 with, or 98, 97 with Scream, really was a trailblazer. But with horror, you've got In the Mouth of Madness by John Carpenter. So another great film.
Super underrated too.
Super underrated. Probably his best movie because it doesn't really deal with horror. It deals with craziness and madness. I mean, it's just right in the title. But you have with... You have classic monsters being represented in 94 on all fronts. You've got Interview with a Vampire. You've got Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And you've got Wolf starring Jack Nicholson. So you've got werewolf, Frankenstein, and vampires. And all three of these movies are expertly done. Wolf, you've got a great cast. Jack Nicholson, James Spader, Christopher Plummer, Michelle Pfeiffer. You've got a great director in Mike Newall. I mean, it's just really a great story about a man, you know, living his mundane life and then going through a change. But then you have Frankenstein, which was done by Kenneth Branagh, a great adaptation, one of the better adaptations from the original and the book by Mary Shelley. But Robert De Niro as Frankenstein monster is probably the best portrayal since Boris Karloff. You've got breakout roles with Tom Hulce and Helena Bonham Carter. But Kenneth Branagh does a really good job with period pieces, and he just he went with it with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. That's pretty much it, because then you just have a bunch of run-of-the-mill horror stuff. But those are my four favorites when it comes to 94. Wes Craven's New Nightmare being my all-time favorite. So
I'd like to submit Blank Man as a horror film. Possible.
Yeah. Okay. And wrapping up the genre stuff, on the sci-fi front, we do get, Star Trek Stargate. Generations. Well, okay. We do get Stargate. And we also get Star Trek Generations, which gives you Kirk and Picard together, for the first time and only time. I know that movie divides a lot of people, but it was still kind of a, you know, still big cultural moment. And Stargate, yeah, becomes this real surprise movie that then inspires like this whole franchise of Stargate stuff, which is still going on in, you know, 25 years later. So, you know,
keeping sci-fi going, sci-fi channels running off it.
what Stargate universe are they on now?
Yeah. I don't know. Cole, that's get Scott here. But actually don't, we're running late enough as it is. But so yeah, okay, so we covered sci-fi, we covered horror. So let's do a little round robin here. Any movies that we haven't covered, either some bigger names or maybe even some deeper cuts from 1994 that you would put forward as something that cements this as one of the better years in movie history. Aaron, let's start with you.
This could be like a whole second podcast because there are so many movies we don't end up talking about that you even put on the list. But so one of the movies that struck me, as you mentioned before, a lot of the action films especially start getting darker, they start getting edgier, is The Professional.
Yes. Leon.
And if you want to talk, yeah, Leon. And if you want to talk Gary Oldman.
Oh yeah.
As a ballistic dude. And again, with the breakout roles, you've got 12-year-old Natalie Portman who enters the acting scene in a role that, I mean, she's a 12-year-old who's learning to become an assassin under insane conditions. So I feel like that's gotta be in there.
Awesome. All right. How about you, Craig?
Just a couple. I mean, I would say more in the kid, because that's who I was at the time. The movie The Pagemaster was just bonkers good, and just a really, really fun movie. And then, of course, Little Giants being in there as well.
Oh, boy.
Absolutely love Little Giants. So I'd mention those two, and then in jest, I would mention The Flintstones, because gotta love me some John Goodman. And it was just a fun film, but those would be my mentions.
Yeah. So Macaulay Culkin, actually, this is a weird year for him because he's trying to get out of the Home Alone.
I'm so sorry. I need to interrupt you. Three Ninjas came out this year.
Yes.
That is my submission.
I'll correct you. Three Ninjas Kickback came out that year, the sequel.
Oh, okay.
Do you still wish to trade out?
I withdraw. Sorry. Sorry for interrupting you.
So Macaulay Culkin, he's trying to break out of this Home Alone thing. So he has three movies this year. So he does The Pagemaster. He does Rich and Rich. And then he does Getting Even with Dad.
He was as busy as Jim Carrey. Think about that.
That's his trilogy. I'm gonna say Jim Carrey's slightly better. Just Getting Even with Dad was the last time I let a friend of mine pick what movie we went to. Because we were like your teen friends, and you're like, okay, what do you want to go see? Let's go see this. And we saw it like, okay, I watch a lot of trash, and even though I know that was bad. Okay, Phil, how about you?
So as I look down this list, there is a lot of, this is going to sound weird, great middling entertainment in this year. Just going on the list, Blown Away, Drop Zone, IQ.
Sans Tommy Lee's awful Irish accent.
Renaissance Man, Blue Chips I would put in this category, With Honors.
The air up there.
Like there's a lot of stuff that when it was on
Hello,
HBO,
Time Cop,
No Escape. I watched this year to death. But there's only one movie that I still carry in my heart, and that is one of the most underrated sports movies of all time. That is Little Big League. It is such a great family movie. It doesn't pander, and it does one thing that I demand of all baseball movies, and that is that the baseball feels authentic. And for a movie that is this ridiculous of a kid taking over a professional baseball team, they get the baseball right. So if you can buy into the sort of weirder, more the bigger story of this kid taking over the management of a baseball team. And that's one that I still to this day, and they use Runaround Sue for a montage. So, I mean, what are you going to do with that? You can't say anything bad about that. And I love that movie to death.
Cool. All right, Ryan, how about you?
I can, you know, being a kid, being eight, I could say Baby's Day Out, or I could make the case for Street Fighter, another Jean-Claude Van Damme classic.
Yes, Street Fighter.
However, I'm going to sum it up in a letter. Dear Darla, I hate your stinking guts. You are scum between my toes. You make me vomit. Love, Alfalfa. Little Rascals, hand down. It just reminds me of my childhood. Little Rascals. I mean, it's a great... Quick, what's the number for 911? I mean, just comedy gold.
Okay, yeah, so great. I'm like you, Phil. I've seen so many of these movies, and there's a wash of, as you said it, there's a wash of, like, really watchable mediocre movies you know, I've seen Major League 2 way more times than I would care to admit.
More than Major League, I'll bet.
More than Major. Yeah. Because Comedy Central ran Major League 2, like TNT ran Shawshank Redemption.
You're right.
It was their Shawshank.
That and basketball.
Yes.
But so a couple of ones that stood out to me, and the first one, I think, similar to Robert Redford having a little bit of prestige, but maybe I think if you're going to give it to a prestige director, I would have taken Quiz Show out, and I would have put in The Paper, Ron Howard's film about a newspaper that has just an amazing cast. Like, it's one of my favorite ensembles ever. Michael Keaton, it's Glenn Close, it's Robert Duvall, it's Randy Quaid. It is so good. It's like peak Michael Keaton. He's so good in that. And it's Marissa Tomei is also in that. Jason Alexander's in that. It's a really good movie and a real kind of love letter to journalism. Which I appreciate. If I'm going to go, we did mention Natural Born Killers, which I don't recommend to everybody, but I think it's an interesting one. But one movie we haven't talked about yet that I really want to make sure we talk about, so I'll put this into, is Ed Wood. Tim Burton doing, ironically, I think it's his best movie, but it's his, like, one of his worst performing movies box office wise. He's coming off of the Batman movies. He's in between like that and then moving on to whatever. And in between, he does this like small movie about whatever.
Edward Scissorhands.
No, Edward Scissorhands was earlier. He moves on to more brooding Johnny Depp movies.
Yeah. He kind of, if he had a genre, would be whatever.
Yeah. This movie, I think it's a great movie about, it's a great performance by Johnny Depp. It's got some, it's a really interesting character piece, and about a guy who's really sincere about making, what ends up being the worst movie of all time. So, those would be my two picks. So let's put a bow on this. Just, final thoughts on the year 1994. Where do you think it stands in the pantheon of great movie years? Phil, let's start with you.
I think there's a lot of rich stuff here. There is stuff I want to revisit. Interview with the Vampire being one of the major ones. When I look over this year, though, there isn't a lot. None of these movies are ones that have stuck with me over time. So I look through it and I'm like, yeah, I had a good time watching a lot of these movies. But we'll say it was a 3-star year that didn't get up towards 4 stars for me.
All right. Ryan, how about you?
I you know, being 8 years old, there was a lot of kid stuff during 94 that really stuck out. Baby's Day Out, Little Giants. I mean, there's a wide variety of stuff. But as I grew older, I did watch more things from the 94, and it does stick out. But Shawshank is one of my top 10 movies. Forrest Gump, I liked it back then, but looking back on it, I don't like it now. But I mean, 94 does genuinely have the stigma of being a breakout year for a lot of actors. And without 94, we would not see these actors. So, I mean, just the storytelling. I mean, you've got Tarantino, Stone, all the directors gave great stuff. So, to me, 94 was one of the best years out there.
All right, Aaron, how about you?
I don't think I could say anything that you guys aren't going to say about these movies. In terms of the acting, the breakouts, and the quality of the films. But what I will say is I'm going to take a moment of silence and pour one out for the kids that'll never know what it's like to walk into a Blockbuster on a Friday night and yes. have no idea walking into what kind of movie their parents are allowing them to rent or what the parents are renting that they're going to end up watching that they may be talking about in 25 years.
Preach.
Yeah.
Now we're just aimlessly streaming, filtering through Netflix. By the way, can I just mention, those are killer earrings. I just noticed those.
Why?
Those are great.
Thank you. Why,
those
thank
are great.
You so much.
Yeah.
Thanks. Absolutely.
All right, Craig, thoughts on 1994 or fashion? Either one. Go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's difficult to argue this year over another year, like, because movie and cinema changed so much, it's hard for me to go anything but decade to decade. So was 1939 the best year in film? Maybe. Was 1974, 1984? What was it? But this, I think it really does go up against 1999. And in my opinion, 1994 is a more solid movie year. And so it's the best film year of the 90s. Just because, to me, it launched so many careers that we still have today. It had the perfect mix of everything from a blockbuster animation film to kind of all these independent films that are coming up and creating these new studios and creating these new names for people to realize. It had a wonderful timepiece film that was led by, you know, the most beloved man in America as its best picture winner. I think it just had a little bit of everything. And like you said, even going in deep cuts, Lou, like the one of the best documentaries ever made, and just so many, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah. And I'm right there with you, Craig. I could understand, and I'd love to, maybe we'll do a separate podcast one day where we debate movie years and make cases. And I'm sure you, and I know that there's cases to be made for a lot of years. But I think your comparison of 94 to 99 is apt because it's at least comparing the best year of the 90s. And I would say the year of 1999 is a more ambitious slate of films. If you look at what's out there, like Fight Club and Matrix and Election and all, and there's lots of ambitious filmmaking that's happening in 99. Mm-hmm. And I guess I think a lot of that doesn't happen without a lot of the films that break out in 1994. So I think if you just look from a historical perspective, I think 1994 just stands up with any year because of what it does in pretty much every genre of film you would want across the board. And then from a business standpoint, the stars that are born, I mean, you could argue this is the birth of the last generation, really, of big time movie stars, because we don't really get big, huge box office draws once we get into the 2000s. It's more franchise driven. Mm. And so here you've got, you know, Jim Carrey, Brad Pitt, Sandra Bullock, Hugh Grant, there's a shift that happens. And so the mix between indie films and mainstream films, all of that stuff, to me, I think it's a year that is, really up at the top. If it's not at the top, I think if it's not the top, it's up at the top. So, that said, there's also, if you want even more 1994, you can, read my article on frnpod.com. We cover a lot of these things, but I also give you a nice list of some of the great bad movies of 1994 that we didn't have time to talk about. There are some doozies. This year gives us the worst movie maybe of all time in North. That is so, like, it may have broke Roger Ebert. And so, I talk about that a little bit. So you can go back and hear that. But, and you can go to that website, frnpod.com, and you can hear everything else that we're doing, all the different articles that are coming up, all of our podcasts. You can find us there. You can also find us now on nprillinois.org. If you, haven't already, you can, all of our main feed is up there, and you can follow us on Facebook, the Front Row Network, where you'll get links to all of our, main feed episodes and all of our, other, shows that we're doing, bonus episodes of Beyond the Mouse, Guilty Pleasures, Pop Culture Draft Night, Flashbacks, Classics, everything that we're doing. I'm not going to say what we have coming up next because I'm not sure exactly when we're releasing this podcast. But there's all sorts of stuff going on, including a bracket podcast that we're doing, or have already done by the time you're hearing this, on the greatest sports movie of all time, that I'm very excited to have you hear and debate and get mad about. But so stay dialed in. And if you haven't already, please make sure you are subscribed to the Front Row Network, wherever you're getting your podcasts. Rate, review, share, help get the word out, and join us over on Facebook or Twitter at Front Row Reviews. Let us know what you think about 1994, the year. Any movies that we missed? Are we way off base here? I think we covered a real wide swath. So I want to thank all you for joining us. I know we ran a little long as per usual, but you know, we had a lot to talk about, and I appreciate that everybody brought your A game and had a lot of great stuff. And hopefully this was as enjoyable for you as it was for me. Where can the people find all of you? What, anything, any projects or anything else you want to plug? Craig, we'll start with you.
Yeah. So two quick things that I already kind of subtly mentioned within the podcast. July 19th, The Lion King comes out. Make sure to check out Beyond the Mouse. We also have our own individual feed and our own individual Facebook page where we talk all things Disney for the Front Row. The second thing is that we are embarking on a journey that will take us through the View Askew-averse of Kevin Smith leading up to Jay and Silent Bob reboot. So come along with us with that. We'll be looking at not necessarily all of his films, but we're talking Clerks, Chasing Amy, Mallrats, Dogma, and then Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. So we'll do those five films.
All right. Phil, what do you got going on?
Well, I have a special Pop Culture Draft Night episode that features me and two of my buddies from back in the day. We get together and talk about the
MCU as a whole, a sort of state of the union, state of the universe, I guess. And these are my old comic book buddies. And if you couldn't get enough of Endgame and MCU talk from the big row that you all had leading up to it, we got a little more there. And then the next draft coming up will be our modes of transportation draft, which I still have not found a pithy name for.
All right. Cool. Ryan, you got anything coming up?
I've been absent on Flashback just because I moved, haven't had a computer of my own on my school laptop, but I will be getting a computer here. I was at Best Buy talking mics and everything, so I'll be getting with Phil to talk how to edit everything, and hopefully I'll be able to make my hosting debut because Scott is still kind of off on the side. And I'm working with Jeremy for something for October, I'm hoping. Hopefully we can roll it out. So
cool.
You got a couple months there, so that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. And Aaron, what about you?
So I don't have my own podcast, but it does sound like I may be invited back for future podcasts, which I'm super pumped about and happy to do. So you might be hearing me here in the future. But I am a nurse and a health and wellness coach. So if you are looking into upgrading your health, your wellness, your fitness, your energy levels, you can find me on Facebook at Aaron E. McCabe or at Instagram at Aaron E. McCabe.
Awesome. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hare. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you guys for being part of this podcast. This was a delight, and hopefully maybe we'll do one of these again. We'll do another yearbook, year in films. We'll pick another year and break down the movies of that year and see how they stack up with 1994. But until next time, for the Front Row Reviews, I'm Lou Hare.
I'm Craig McFarland.
I'm Ryan Lutens.
I'm Aaron McCabe.
And I'm Phil Rockwell.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.